Omaha Public Radio presents another program from Project Interfaith on Noon Forum. We'll hear a lecture by Tamim Ansari, author of several books, including The Widow's Husband, West of Kabul, East of New York, and Destiny Disrupted, A History of the World Through Islamic Eyes, which won the 2010 Northern California Book Award for General Nonfiction. He'll speak on the topic, An Afghan-American Odyssey, My Bicultural Life in a Post-9/11 World. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday evening, April 7, 2011, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of Project Interfaith, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the speaker is Beth Katz, Executive Director of Project Interfaith.
We're very, very grateful to have Tamim Ansari here with us tonight. He is a very gifted writer and speaker and lecturer who has authored several books on Islam and on Afghanistan, but also he writes prolifically about a whole variety of topics if you check out his blog. You can read his full bio in your programs, but I'm going to shut up now and turn it over to Tamim so you can really get to the heart of why we're here tonight. So please join me in welcoming Tamim Ansari.
Thank you, Beth. Thank you, Project Interfaith. And thank you all for being here. I'm going to tell you what I can think of about my bicultural life in a post-9/11 world. Is that my topic? I think I'm just going to go back and, for those of you who don't know, fill in a little bit about who I am and why I have a bicultural life. My father was sent to America in the late 30s, early 40s. He was one of the first Afghan students sent here to study. He married my mother, an American woman, and took her back to Afghanistan. She was the first American woman to marry an Afghan and go back and live with him in the country. And then my sister and I were born, and so we were the first Afghan Americans. And I grew up, in a sense, straddling two worlds when I was in Afghanistan. Already there was a foot in the American camp, a foot in the Afghan camp. you speak of the Interfaith Council, and I feel like I'm an interfaith kind of guy because, my identity represents a cross currents and streams from many places, and I feel like I'm partially inside a lot of different frameworks, and also I'm sort of an observer of a lot of different spiritual traditions, ethnic cultures, and so on. And, in these later times when the relationship between the Western civilization and, and Islam has grown so contentious, going back to 1978, 1979, when the hostages were taken by the revolutionary Islamic students in Iran, the American hostages. And in that period, all of a sudden, I saw so many articles in the newspaper all of a sudden explaining to Americans what Islam was about. And what struck me was that the description of Islam that I read in these newspaper articles didn't really match up to my experience of Islam growing up in Afghanistan, very much inside a Muslim culture. At that point, I went on a journey with my head already thinking about what I was going to write. I was sort of intent on launching my career as a journalist, so I thought I should go and interview people in the Muslim world and then come back and write my stories. But in a sense, I had already written my stories in my head before I went, and I was just going to get the quotes that I would need. But when I traveled through the Muslim world in 1979, I experienced that, there was a lot more going on and there were different sorts of things going on than I had in my head and that I remembered from my childhood. And so years later, when I wrote my memoir, West of Kabul, East of New York, I started out by talking about how Islam was in Afghanistan when I was growing up. And the main thing that I think I wanted to bring across and that struck me thinking about Islam at that point was that there was nobody in my environs in all of the world that I knew who wasn't a Muslim. So in my context, it wasn't a question of Islam versus something else. Everybody was a Muslim. And the question was only, are you a good Muslim or are you a bad Muslim? You know, and there was also some question of, are you an observant Muslim or are you not an observant Muslim? But observant and non-observant didn't necessarily mean, didn't necessarily equate to good Muslim or bad Muslim. That was somewhat of a separate question. Years later, when I looked into this, I realized that Islam in every culture that it's gone into has melted to a certain amount into the culture, and there has become a fuzzy line between what is the religion and what is the culture. So that Islam in Afghanistan probably is different from Islam in Morocco and Islam in Indonesia. And some of the things that that were characteristics of Islam when I was growing up might actually be characteristics of Afghan culture. So there is that to consider. But in my environs, in my family, when I was growing up, you know, Islam was just part of everyday life, and it was everyone either did it or felt themselves to be Muslims. The question of saying your five daily prayers, some people did, some people didn't, you know, and in our household, in our various compounds, when it was time for prayer, different people just got up and did what they had to do, their ablutions, and then they stood someplace in a quiet spot and turned their face to Qibla, the direction of Mecca, and they performed their prayers. Sometimes people went to the mosque, but not everyone did. And when it was sort of time for prayer, there was a sense of everything quieting down for that, you know, and then when it was over, it was released back into the usual everyday activity. And you know, when the time of year came around that people are supposed to, in which people are supposed to fast, that was an atmosphere and a mood that pervaded the whole society. And even as a little kid, there was always this kind of excitement about, oh, the Ramadan is coming up, I'm going to try, you know. And then I'd usually make it about a day or half a day, or I'd skip breakfast. But in those early parts of the month of fast, when I was trying to do it, part of the ritual is that you get up before dawn and you have a little meal of some kind, and that was part of the sense of what fasting was all about. That was a closeness with my father, our family. We got up, and then the day dawned and everybody was fasting. And everywhere you went, instead of being a grim ritual that people, you know, oh, I wish I didn't have to fast, but they make me. Actually, nobody made you, and people were sort of like, this was a quest, and, you know, how's the fast going? And it was the topic of conversation that you might exchange with people when you see them. And also, to be honest, you know, when the month of fast came around, during the working hours, people were a little more unenergetic, so not as much got done. And then, you know, when the time came to break the fast, and you got out on the porch with your family, and you got your date, because that's traditionally what you break the fast with, and you waited for the cannon that would signal, you know, now you can do it. Then everybody ate their date, and it was like this great moment. And then the feasting and celebration could begin. You know, it's an ironic point that many Muslims gain weight during the month of Ramadan, because the feast, you know, you can feast all you want after that time. When I went to school, religion was part of the curriculum. I was never very good at it, to tell you the truth. Religion was learning to read the Quran. Part of that is the process of actually learning to read it, because, you know, even though Farsi is written in the same script as Arabic, Arabic has diacritical marks, and it's complicated and difficult to read the Quran in the classical Arabic script. So we had to learn that. But also, right from first grade, there was the qiraat, you know, the incantatory way of chanting the Quran, which is rhythmic, musical, and people who are good at it just put this immense passion into I don't want to call it singing the Quran because it's not singing. It's this thing that's doesn't apply to any other text. It's the only text that people read in this way. And, you know, some of the kids in my class were good at it, and the teacher would say, come on, you show the class your chops. Do it. You know, go, show the kids. And me, unfortunately, I was never very good. I just couldn't get it. But I liked listening to it. And then there was the calligraphy, you know, because the art of calligraphy is very bound up with the sense of the sacred that applies to the book. And so writing the shapes of the letters of the Quran is also a devotional act. And as students, you learn that. But then we also had mathematics and Farsi literature and all these other things. And so Islam was part of everyday life in that sense when I was growing up in Afghanistan. Now, you know, there was a certain amount of the various axes along which people could practice the version of Islam that they embraced. There were people who were, grim. There were grim mullahs who held people's feet to the fire and said, "This is how you're supposed to do it." And they criticized people who weren't being observant in exactly the way they thought they should. But in Afghanistan, the thing that happened to Islam when it came there and sank into the soil of that culture is that the sort of the other pole of Islam, the Sufi pole, which is the mystical approach to Islam, it became very honored and characteristic of Islam in that part of the world. And people who practiced Sufism had prestige and were greatly respected in the society. Now, for those of you who don't know, let me just say that, in the history of Islam, Sufism is that aspect of Islam that emerged when, at a certain point in the development of the religion, some people felt like there must be more to religion than just performing the prayer just right and following the rules as prescribed in this set of in this code of jurisprudence that the scholars have laid down. That's okay, there is that, but some people were saying, I don't feel God out of this. I don't feel closer to God. What? There's got to be more to this. And then there came to be some individuals who tried to break through to some spiritual experience by seeking excess in their ritual observances. You know, there was a guy who went to Mecca and stood in front of, the Kaaba, the central shrine of Islam, and said prayer every day for a year, and hoping maybe that'll do it. And there was other people who did extreme things like that. And here and there were people who seemed to themselves or to people who heard about them to have made it to some other spiritual plane. So then those guys attracted followers who said, what are you doing? Show me how to do what you're doing. I want to get there too. There was also a seminal breakthrough at a certain point when some of these mystics, some of these Sufis, began to practice a Sufism of love in contrast to the religion of fear. You know, you must fear God as one of the sort of injunctions of Islam, but this new kind of Sufi said, no, getting close to God is like a love affair. You know, it's like, and they wrote passionate poetry that sounded just like love poetry, but it was love of God is what they were expressing. And this kind of Sufism also then spread and proliferated. And it came to Afghanistan. And many Afghan poets were Sufis in those days. I'm not sure there were any that weren't, so poetry and Sufism went together. And many Sufis were poets, although not all. And some of the Sufis in Afghanistan that had some eminence were people in my ancestral line. You know, the Ansaris produced a number of these famous poets. My own great-great-great, three greats, I may have run away with myself, there's three greats and a grandfather, great-great-great-grandfather. That fellow, we knew that he was our great forebear, and he was a Sufi poet, and I knew a little bit about him in that way. We all did. I always thought he was the greatest poet of Afghanistan in his era, until later I began to meet other Afghans here who said, you know, I descended from so-and-so who was the greatest Afghan poet of his era. And when we traced back, we found that we're all talking about the same era. I knew my guy, they knew their guy. And so I think there's a lot of poets back in about the 1750s, the 1800s. That's when my ancestor lived. But that was also part of my sense of myself in terms of religion. I come from the mystical tradition of Islam, and I guess I felt like I took a certain family pride in coming from a line of poets and Sufi mystics, except when I went to school and our prestige in that sense had preceded us, and the theology teacher said, you are a Ansari, get up here and perform a prayer, show the other boys how to do it. And then I was never good at it, and I made mistakes, and that was humiliating to me. So I'm just giving you a picture of the different kinds of experiences you might have if you're a Muslim growing up in Afghanistan. My experience was somewhat skewed because in those early days especially, it was clear to everybody that I was different from other Afghans because my mother was American and I looked it. So there was that little characteristic feature of Islam as I experienced it. But still, it was so evident to me that that what people meant by Islam basically was how to be a good person. You know, and it was framed in the rituals and the fasting and, you know, and saying, La ilaha illallah, Muhammad Rasulullah, you know, you have to say that, testify to that truth that there's only one God, Muhammad is his messenger. Those are the things that make you a Muslim. But I don't think my father was alone in his attitude. What he told me is he said, you know, son, you just be a good neighbor, be a good father, be a good friend, and don't cheat, don't lie, don't trick anyone, don't take other people's property, and you'll and that's good. Then you're a Muslim. Fundamentally, that's what it's about, you know. And I always thought that was what fundamentalist Muslims meant. And so when I when the hostages were taken and these articles were written, and the articles generally focused in on a couple of things. You know, the hands of thieves are supposed to be cut off. That's what Muslims do. Apostates are killed. Women are oppressed, and there might have been one or two other things, but that was like the picture of Islam. And all of this other stuff that I experienced growing up just wasn't in that picture at all. So I went out there to say, okay, there is I'll get some quotes and then I'll come back and write what Islam is really about. But when I went out there, I found that another thing had entered into the practice of religion and the sense of religion that people had, which was a political movement. And those two things had created another river of Islam, and that's out there too. And since then, you know, that movement, which is Islam, which uses Islam as a platform, that's the face of Islam that we have been experiencing and know about here so much, because 9/11 was perpetrated by practitioners of that idea and that kind of Islam. Since 9/11, I think I can say with some confidence that while that movement, which is sometimes called Islamism rather than Islam, while it's it definitely is a vigorous movement in the world, and or has been I don't know if it's maybe losing some of its steam now, but while it's been a vigorous movement in the world, the great majority of Muslims are not Islamists, and they feel the same way towards those Islamists as people who are not Muslims, you know. So that's what I've experienced. Now, however, the experience for Muslims here in America, and I guess I know Afghan Americans best, you know, in that regard, there has been a problematic aspect for Muslims after 9/11. And it begins not in 9/11. I'll localize this by talking about Afghan Americans first. You know, when the Afghans came streaming out of Afghanistan because the Soviets had conquered the country and were tearing it apart, and so many, many Afghans came here as refugees, and they came fleeing from, you know, incredible horrors and devastating experiences. And then they took root here, and people who had been doctors in Afghanistan became cab drivers here, and people who had been ministers of something or other became cashiers in a store here. But they somehow hung on, and they somehow managed to survive and build some kind of a life so that their kids could go to school and make something of themselves. That was the immigrant experience of most Afghans. But for the kids, I discovered not too long ago, I mean, I kind of suspected this, but a few years ago, I decided to do a writing project with Afghan-American young adults who were either born here or came here at a very young age. And I thought, you know, this new immigrant community, this is an experience, this is an American experience that won't be known about 50 years from now. And those who are going through it should write about it. And Afghan Americans were not doing any writing that I knew about, except for, you know, Khalid Hosseini and me. So I dug up as many of these young 20 to 30-year-olds that I could find and pleaded with them to come into these workshops. And they started to write about their experiences. And what I realized was that even before 9/11, they had a problem of fitting into America because their home environment consisted of their parents' generation who wanted to recreate Afghanistan in their private homes. They didn't want to let go of it, and they were very firm that, you know, when you step in the door, you got to speak Farsi, you got to be a Muslim, you got to, you know, follow all the customs, and people did. And, you know, the parents arranged marriages, and, you know, people married their relatives, and all those things that happened in Afghanistan happened here. But those kids went to school. You know, they went out. They were part of America when they left the house. And over time, they felt like they didn't fit into their homes. But they also didn't fit into their schools and outside. And one guy said to me, you know, I feel like I'm pretending to be an Afghan when I go home. But then I go to school and I feel like I'm pretending to be an American. And I ask myself, when am I not pretending? And that is that's a difficult experience to go through, and it's a ratcheting up and an intensification of the experience that young people have as teenagers. Everybody's sort of been through something like that, but for this immigrant community, and I think for many Muslim communities, immigrant communities in America, this experience is more intense than it is for the average American. And so this drives people to seek identity, you know, something that they can say, this is me. And for these younger Afghans growing up, they can't seek it by embracing something in America. They feel like they have to embrace Afghanistan and what they have there. But many of these guys never were in Afghanistan, or if they were, they only remember it vaguely. So they're seeking their identity in something that's imagined. And many of these young people that joined my writing project, you know, they spoke of an alienation from the Afghanistan that their parents spoke about. They wanted to believe in it, but they couldn't quite get it. And so many then seek that sense of identity in Islam, because you can find out about Islam and you can be a Muslim no matter where you are. But after 9/11, these guys are in a position of looking for their identity by embracing the thing that the majority of the society, the world out there, is beaming a certain hostility, contempt, and hatred towards the thing you want to try to find your identity in. And that's really painful. And now these guys, I don't know if this is the case for immigrant communities of other countries. It's certainly the case for Afghanistan, and I wouldn't doubt that it also holds for many of these other communities, because many people have come here running from catastrophe. And so for the young Afghans, here's their situation. They live in the shadow of their parents' catastrophe. What they're suffering is nothing compared to what their parents went through. You know, their parents saw their best friends die in bombing, and their parents lost everything they owned, and they got out here with virtually nothing. And so how can their kids complain, because they feel alienated at high school? So they feel like they have no story. You know, they feel like they have nothing important. They feel like their pain is not important, you know, and that's actually just saying that kind of brings tears to my eyes right here. I was very moved by that. And once I got these guys writing their stuff, they came up with some really moving, interesting little essays. There was one young woman who wanted to write about her grandmother dying. And so she wrote something, and it was kind of sentimental. You know, it's like, I love my grandmother. I went to see her every day. And then she got sick, and she died, and we were all so sorry. She was a great, she gave me candy. I love my grandmother. And it's like, well, that's pretty good. You know, all your sentences are good. I feel like you go a little further with this. And so she wrote more, and she wrote more. And then all of a sudden, one day, she broke through to what it was. You know, she broke through to the fact that that she loved her grandmother and she was close to her grandmother. But when her grandmother died, this big family, clan, community, you know, funeral thing happened. The death of somebody is a very big event in the Afghan community. People come. And she was relegated to the role of bringing, of serving the guests, and, you know, being a worker in this huge event that occurred, and her own family was not acknowledging that she was the one who had really suffered a loss here. So I just thought that was great that and that she sort of found that, and then once that came out, oh, the writing just came pouring out of this young woman. There was another piece that I really love. It's been reprinted in many places. It was called Cab Driver's Daughter. And it's written by a young woman who is now a medical professional of some kind. She's a pediatrician or something. She went to med school. Now she's a doctor. And she's on her way to school and or to work. And she's wearing hijab, you know, and she's dressed in a Muslim fashion. And she overhears someone saying, you know, there's a Muslim world. I bet her father makes her dress like that. Or maybe she's married and her husband makes her do that. And then she wrote this piece about her father and, you know, how he used to be a university professor in Afghanistan, but now here, you know, he's a cab driver. And every morning he gets up, or when she was going to med school, every morning he got up and he made breakfast so that she would, you know, she would have a good breakfast to go to med school. And then he went out and he worked this cab 12 hours a day to try to get the money together so that his daughter could go to med school. And she paints a portrait of a guy who's just tender, loving, hardworking, and loves his daughter, and he's a cab driver. And she says, I'm proud to say I'm that cab driver's daughter. Well, after after 9/11, in the year after that, in fact, right after the Taliban were driven out of Kabul, I finally had a chance to go back to Afghanistan. I hadn't been back there since I left in 1964. I had not been back because every year since 1964, there was some reason to wait a little longer till things got better. And they never got better. They got worse. So in 2002, finally, it looked like there was a break in the clouds. The Taliban were gone, and I went back. And I had the wonderful experience. Afghanistan was such a happy place at that moment because everyone thought the war was over. And I did a lot of things. I went a lot of places. And then one of the things that I did, you know, my cousin's son Riaz is here, and he will know that it was his mother who said, "You should go and do ziyarat, you know, visit, do a pilgrimage to the shrine of your great-great-great-grandfather, Sheikh Saaduddin." And I was like, well, okay, you know, that should be interesting. I'd never been there when I was a kid. And I knew that it was near our ancestral village, the next village over. But it never occurred to me to go, and it didn't occur to anybody to take me there. So we got in a car, and there was a qari with us, I remember now. Qari is a professional singer of, you know, or chanter of Quran. And in this case, the guy also professionally chanted in a very melodic sort of musical way other poetry. So he was a kind of a poetry singer. And he was a religious guy. So we headed off to this place, and the traffic in Kabul makes Boston seem like you're in the Mojave Desert. It is the most incredible experience. I mean, like, nobody, I'm sure it's that way still, but when I was there, nobody attends at all to this quaint tradition of lanes. And the idea that some lanes go this way and some lanes go that way, it's like, nah, it's not happening. And so people, you know, they get around, they scoot, they zip into spaces, but inevitably there comes a occasional moment when nobody can move. And I got in one of those. And we had a driver and, you know, my cousin Zoya, that was with us, and this qari. And there was not, every car was just in random, as far as the eye could see, every car was pointed in some random direction. Now, you know, in L.A., if you were to get into a situation like that, somebody was going to get shot pretty soon. And it was a hot day, too. But my cousin Zoya, that said, well, we're going to the shrine, and we should have some candy to give out. I'm going to go get some candy. And the driver said, I'll go with you. So those two guys left. And and all around us, I saw people had come out of their cars, and they were chatting with whoever else was there. Nobody seemed to be taking this as a frustrating, annoying thing. Nobody acted like I was acting in Denver 3 hours ago when they wouldn't tell me when the plane was leaving. It was like, well, here we are, and so as long as we're here, let's socialize. Everybody was strangers, but they were talking and chatting. Then this guy started talking to me, this qari, bearded, you know, traditional-looking guy with a long shirt and baggy trousers, and looked like the standard Afghan villager. And he suddenly said to me, you know, my religion is 30% Zohiri and 70% Batini. Zohiri means outer, and Batini means inner. So what he was saying is the rituals and the things that other people can see, my religion is only 30% that. And the other 70% is something internal that nobody else can see. And I said, oh, that's interesting. You know, so what can you tell me about that? And then he told me this long story. He said at some point he had fallen in love with a girl. And And he was just passionately, desperately in love with her. But the family didn't want them to marry. And the family broke them up. And then she was, then the family or somehow, or her and some group left the country and they went to America. And so now his beloved was in some place called Arizona. And he decided, you know, he'll go there and he'll win her back and he'll convince the family that he's worthy. And he was trying to think how he could do that, but nobody would tell him where in Arizona she was. And he then learned that Arizona is this huge place and you can't just go to Arizona and find her. And finally, he gave up. And somewhere in that process, he said, he all of a sudden had the mystical experience and he broke through. And his love for this woman was replaced by his love for God. And it was the love, he said, that Jahona Dharmeta, it burns down the universe. And I was impressed. You know, I was like, whoa, that's, I really liked hearing that. So then my cousin comes back with the candy, and the driver comes back, and I never saw anyone directing traffic, but gradually somehow it sorted itself out. The cars are moving. And we're driving along. Now we're on a road. We've left the city. There's cars, you know, quite a few of them, one after another. And we get to a place where there's a bridge that's washed out, and people have to go down and pass through a very narrow place going through the stream. And we're like maybe the 100th car. This is actually a tangent, but I just want to tell you guys this. We're maybe the 100th car, you know, the 50th car. It's a long line. And so it's going to be another long wait. But suddenly the driver just zips out of the line, and he goes like on the side of the hill. The car is like at 45-degree angle. I said, what are you doing? When you get to the front, you're not going to be able to get in. He said, watch me. And he drove, and he never even slowed down. He just like when he got there, he just, boom, he found an opening, and he was in there and across this bridge. We skipped the 50 cars. So we got across. And then we went through my ancestral village of Diaya. And then, you know, then that was behind us. And now we're just out in the desert. And we're just driving along, and I'm like, where are we going? This is like there's no town, there's no village. And then all of a sudden I see this huge thing looming up in the distance. And it's like a very poor man's Taj Mahal. You know, it's like it's made of mud with tiling on it, but it has domes, you know, and it's an edifice of some grandeur. And that turns out to be the shrine of my great-great-great-grandfather. So we go there, we park, and we walk into the you know, there's a arched doorway. And above that doorway, there is a couplet written in Farsi, which evidently comes from my ancestors' poetry. And that couplet goes like this. I'm going to say it in Farsi, and then I'll tell you guys what it means. The couplet goes, می شود پیدا شراب از تاک خشک خاک ما بوی جان می آید از خاک گل نمناک ما از گل خاک نمناک ما. And that means wine somehow appears from the desiccated vines of our dry soil. The aroma of soul rises up from the moist mud of our land. And we go inside, and the place is jam-packed with people, men and women. And they're in the courtyard. They're saying they're performing their ablutions. There's a stream that goes through there. There was no stream outside, and there's no stream on the other side. There's a stream there. I don't know how that happened. And so we go in, and we go into the room where his actual grave is. And it's open at the top so that rain can fall on the actual grave, but the grave is surrounded by a wooden sort of lattice work, and there's vines growing up. And there's six or seven guys there, and we sit with them. And they say, you should go and pray. But pray at your ancestors' shrine. And I don't pray at shrines. You know, it's not something I do. And so I felt awkward. But it looked like there was an expectation that I should do this, especially because I'm the descendant of this guy. And so, you know, I went and I knelt down and I did this. You know, this is the attitude of prayer, and this thing. It's as if water is coming down, and then when you're done, you kind of wash your face with this. So you say stuff, and I don't. It's like, what do you say? I don't know. You know, it's like it was in your head. And nobody can see what I'm saying. And you know, I've just come from San Francisco, and I'm thinking it's really amazing that in four generations that human life could move so far, and so there could be such extreme changes. You know, this guy, he lived and died in this setting right here in this mud village, and you know, his grandchildren moved to this unimaginable huge city of Kabul, and then their grandchildren came to America, and one of them married an American, and then his great 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 grandchild, now he lives in San Francisco. You know, he's a writer. His life has nothing to do with, and it's not at all like this. Like this scene at all. And meanwhile, you know, lyrics from rock songs are passing through my head for some reason. It's just, you know, the thoughts will go where they will go. And as this happens, I guess I found myself kind of addressing these thoughts to this guy. You know, instead of just thinking this, I was saying, I have traveled so far from where you were and what kind of life you lived. And as I'm saying this, all of a sudden, I hear people chanting the Quran. You know, that characteristic qiraat is happening. And the weird thing is, I understand the words. And I'm like, wow, I learned Arabic or something spontaneously. And then I realize, no, it's not the Quran. They're chanting in Quran-like fashion the poetry of this guy. And I focus on the lyrics, and the song that they're singing is something that is dear to my heart. You know, it's like, you guys are the Interfaith Council, so you should appreciate this. It's a poem in which it's couplets, and the first half of each couplet is an original line, and then the second half is the same line repeated. It's a refrain. So the first couplet, the first half might say something like, whether you're in the Buddhist temple or in the mosque or in the church, that's the original line. The second line is, Hamarangi yora dorad. All of it has the color of love. Then it's, you know, some other set of things. Everything has the color of love. You know, the wine pourer, the wine itself, and the entire tavern. It's all the color. It has the color of love. And it goes on and on. They're chanting this thing, and they're, you know, it's this expression of pantheistic. I think tolerance is too weak a word. You know, it's like embrace and expansive. Putting your arms around everything. And that's what my ancestor was writing in this place. And I feel like if I had the chops, I would like to write stuff like that right now. And it's at that moment that I hear this voice saying, see, you're not that far. You haven't gone that far away. And I actually looked around, you know, it's like, where is that? And I realized it was a voice in my head. And I'm not going to assign any status to that experience. You know, I don't know. All I say is this happened, and that's how I experienced it. And then I went and I sat down, and they had a big book of his poetry. And they were passing it around, and different people were singing, and they all sang in a different style. And some of them couldn't read, but they'd memorized it. But they still held the book and sang it. And, you know, this is Sufism, and this is part of what Islam is in Afghanistan. And it's not all of what Islam is, you know. Islam also is dogmatic, fierce, politicized something, and the Taliban were exponents of that. The original Taliban, there, I think there's something different going on now, but those original Taliban were, you know, part of a movement that believed that, and among the movements and the ideas that they attacked most savagely was Sufism, and their kind of Islam, to my mind, did not exist before, say, the Soviet invasion. And then in the course of that war, when the Afghans rallied under the banner of Islam to defeat the Soviets, a lot of other stuff came in. And now this is in play. This is also part of Afghan Islam. That's what I have to tell you. I think I should conclude in some way. I should draw some conclusion. I don't know exactly what conclusion to draw. I will tell you this. I grew up in Islam, and then I left Afghanistan, and I wandered away from Islam, and I will never go back to anything like a Talibanist Islam. It has nothing for me that appeals to me, and I don't regard it as being part of my heritage at all. But actually, since 9/11, I've kind of looked at what Islam is all about and what I embrace, and I think actually, to my surprise, those are the same things as I see them. You know, I look back at the source of Islam in a in a metaphorical, allegorical, emotional sense, and I see it as being rooted in the experience of Muhammad in his lifetime and the community as it existed that he built. And I see that it's all about, it's all about harmony in the community and social justice. And it's also, to me, it really does seem to be also about giving each person the authority to have direct connection with God, which to me is a form of empowering of individual experience, and that's I never used to perform namaz in Afghanistan, but I do now. I don't do it all the time. I don't do it five times a day, but I do it, and I don't do it from a sense of obligation. I do it from a sense of it's kind of like for me that I do it, not for the bearded guys. Of course, I have a beard, but it's so little of a beard that this would have gotten me executed in Taliban days in Afghanistan. Thank you all.
Thank you very much. See, I told you'd be glad you came tonight. Now we're going to turn it over to you for questions that you'd like to put to Tamim. So if you'd like to raise your hand, we'll come over and give you an opportunity to ask those.
So much of what you said, particularly at the beginning of your talk, would apply as well to Judaism, because Judaism is often described as a religious community. So I wonder if you could comment on that. And then my second comment is, are Islam and are the terms Islam and Muslim synonymous or not?
Islam is the religion and Muslim is a person who follows the religion. So they're just different parts of speech. Islam, let's see, means submission or yielding. And that idea is that it's the religion of yielding to God. And Muslim is one who yields. So that's the connection between those words. I started out saying I'm an embodiment of interfaith, this and that. I'm married to a Jewish woman, so I'm close to that community too. And because I am aware of the fact that Islam and Judaism are so close to being the same religion. The fact that these two are at each other's throats is a historical circumstance, not a a doctrinal quarrel. I was made startlingly aware of this when I was listening to at some ceremony that the Hanukkah ceremony, and people were singing Baruch Atah Adonai Moloch Alam, and I said, Moloch, wait a minute, Alam, what do those words mean? What does this little thing mean? And so they translated the thing, and I realized that it's practically the same as the head note of the Quran, Alhamdulillah Rabbil Alameen, Malik Yawmuddin, Malik, Malak, those are all the roots are the same. They're two Semitic languages, and the devotional essence of what people are trying to express is the same thing. So there's that. Then later, I was I had a job. I was writing a kids' encyclopedia, and my assignment was to write about different religions for kids. And it was an encyclopedia, and it was a kids' encyclopedia. So I had like 300 words. What is Judaism? 300 words. What is Islam? 300 words. What is Christianity? 500 words. What is religion? But even so, I was doing research, And in the course of that research, I ran across a website called Judaism 101, which was very detailed about all the different things that are incumbent upon Jews who are observant. And I was like, oh, man, this is all the same stuff. The Jewish people have more than we have. It's like when it comes to diet, we don't have this milk and meat thing and some other stuff. But a lot of it is the same. And I feel like the spirit of it is the same. And, when you consider that except for Jesus Christ and Muhammad, Jews and Muslims have all the same prophetic reference points going back to Adam. It's like Abraham is in both traditions. Noah's in both traditions. David is in both traditions. Moses, all the way back. There are some differences in how some of the stories are told, but they're very similar. Yes.
As America attempts to extricate itself out of Iran, and with your visiting Afghanistan, I don't know when most recently, but do you see that the realism of Americans able to get out of Afghanistan so that you can run your own affairs happening in the next 5 years, 10 years?
the one problematic aspect of that sentence you just said, America getting out of Afghanistan so we can run our own affairs, assumes that if America gets out of Afghanistan, Afghans will then be running their own affairs. Actually, there are so many other great powers hovering on every side of Afghanistan, and I just don't think that if America gets out, somebody else won't come rushing in. Already those other powers are just pushing. It's just like you can see it. Iran is every day pushing into. China is not an aggressive pusher, but it's in Afghanistan very, very much. They've got they've signed up the rights to a lot of those minerals, and Russia is now back in there. They're supplying helicopters. They're sending troops in. But I do think, I guess I will say this. I feel like we're in a new great game situation. It's much more heavy duty. It's much more complicated. But it is a situation in which the real interests of great powers are best served if there is a neutral sovereign Afghanistan. And if the great powers would have to agree to do this, they'd have to agree to guarantee the borders amongst each other. If there was a sovereign Afghanistan, its foreign policy would be non-aligned neutrality, because that's the only policy that makes sense for a sovereign Afghanistan. And every Afghan ruler who has had a shot at sovereignty has immediately gravitated over to that. You know, it's like that's just what's going to happen. So that if America get out, the interests of America would be served. But there are complications that I just never want to not be frank about. You can't be in a high-tension situation like it is in Afghanistan and just pull out and expect that it won't be a terrible moment of violence afterwards. And I'm not sure how that's going to be forestalled. Ultimately, I hope America does come out, everybody stays out, and Afghanistan becomes sovereign. So that's what I hope.
Well, I think our time is up together, so please join me in thanking Tamim for a very engaging evening.
You've been listening to a program from Project Interfaith on Noon Forum. We've heard a lecture by Tamim Ansari, author of several books, including The Widow's Husband, West of Kabul, East of New York, and Destiny Disrupted, A History of the World Through Islamic Eyes, which won the 2010 Northern California Book Award for General Nonfiction. He spoke on the topic, An Afghan-American Odyssey, My Bicultural Life in a Post-9/11 World. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday evening, April 7, 2011, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Beth Katz, Executive Director of Project Interfaith, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.